From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. And this week, we devote the whole hour to our upcoming quadrennial exercise in participatory democracy and the attendant efforts of political practitioners at mind control. It's 3 weeks before the election. Do you know where your judgment is?
Because political manipulation is a gavotte that requires two willing partners. You may not be altogether aware that you are, in fact, dancing, but more and more, researchers are able to peer into parts of you otherwise invisible and inaccessible to show that you are performing the steps in perfect time. For instance, you may believe yourself to be independent.
Are independents really as independent as they say they are or that they think they are?
University of Virginia psychology professor Brian Nosek is one of the founders of Project Implicit, a test designed to reveal how we really feel. Researchers found that among self-described independents, two-thirds identified implicitly as either Republican or Democratic.
But the real interest is, does that predict their behavior? And so we had these independents judge some policy proposals, and we randomly assigned the different policies to be proposed by Democrats or Republicans. In one case, we had people evaluate two welfare policy proposals. One welfare plan was relatively generous, and the other welfare plan was relatively stringent. Those are ordinarily associated with Democrats and Republicans, respectively. But we randomly assigned for each participant which one was proposed by the Democrat and which one was proposed by the Republican. And what we found was that even among independents, there was a reliable tendency to prefer the one that they implicitly identified with.
There's a certain amount of irony there. Those who say, I am independent, I use the facts, are the ones who are actually more deluded about what their real state is.
Yeah, I guess that's a negative way to understand it. But a positive framing would be that the conscious stance of I am independent, even when implicitly I am not, may be a way to strive for independence. We don't have to define our identities in terms of what we really are. We can define our identities in terms of what we would like to be.
Aspirational identification.
Right. Those aspirational identities are ways for us to try to shape our own behavior. Because the only way to actually become independent is to desire it. That's an essential first step.
Truth be told, we make most of our choices pretty much mindlessly by using our instincts, senses, muscle memory, mental shortcuts known as heuristics. An outfielder, for instance, can't actually calculate the trajectory of an incoming ball, so he uses mental shortcuts to judge speed and distance and position himself for the catch. We use heuristics for driving, and we use them for political decisions, too.
Voters, particularly when they're forced to make decisions under what we call thin slice conditions. That means you have a thin slice of time and you have very thin slice information or almost no information at all.
Scripps College psychology professor Michael Spazio studies political heuristics.
Any voter who says they're undecided at this point is pretty much working off of these heuristics and probably not all that tuned in to information. Saturday Night Live had an interesting sketch about these folks a couple of weeks ago. The sketch depicted the undecided voter as pretty much informationally clueless about almost everything.
What are the names of the two people running? And be specific.
How long is a president's term of office? 1 year? 2 years? 3 years? Or life?
The less informed a voter is, they will be most dependent on heuristic processing. They will not be able to engage in analytic processing. They may be thinking that they are, but it's actually an illusion.
Spazio was the lead author of a study in which volunteers were asked to choose a candidate, candidates unknown to them, after viewing their pictures, sometimes for less than a tenth of a second. Then their choices were compared to how those candidates actually fared in real-world elections. The volunteers were much better at predicting the losers than the winners.
We saw this effect most strongly when people were asked, which candidate is more threatening? We didn't mean which candidate is more fiscally threatening or which candidate is going to run the government more into the ground. What we said essentially is, which candidate looks more likely to physically attack you? And people actually pick out the loser more often when they decide which candidate of the pair looks more physically ready to attack you.
So we're more likely to vote against than to vote for a candidate. And we're motivated mostly by fear, not just of incompetence or the fleeting sense that a candidate might punch us. We're also terrified by anything that threatens our convictions. Emory University professor Drew Weston is the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. In a 2006 fMRI study, he used brain scans to see what happens inside a voter's head when confronted with candidates' statements that showed lying or pandering. The volunteers in the study had no trouble reasoning when dealing with the incriminating statements of the opposing candidate, but when they confronted hypocrisy from their own candidate, they were lost in space.
The first thing that was activated were a series of negative emotion circuits that were basically, for any of your listeners who can remember Lost in Space, it was Will Robinson, danger, danger. They saw danger, they saw threat, and you could see it all over their brains. Then what you saw was activation in a part of the brain called the anterior cingulate. It monitors and deals with conflict. So you could see that they were in conflict. They were trying to figure out a way out of that conflict. And then you saw, after they had come to their conclusion that there was really no problem for their guy, what you saw was activation in parts of the brain that are very rich in the neurotransmitters that are involved in reward. These are the circuits in the brain that get activated when junkies get their fix.
You mean once they figured out how best to lie to themselves, they got a blast of oxytocin or something?
Very, very close. That's right. So they got this huge blast of dopamine, which is involved in reward.
In other words, the same thing you get when you take Coke.
That's exactly right. There was no reasoning at all going on.
It gets worse. I'm going to assume that most of you listening to the show are, if not news junkies, pretty well informed. So does that protect you? No, it does not.
We looked at how well informed they were generally about politics based on answers to quiz questions about political figures and which party controls Congress and the like.
Larry M. Bartels is the co-director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions at Vanderbilt University. He found that the more you know, the better you are at self-deception. Take the fact that the budget deficit declined by roughly 90% over Bill Clinton's first term.
Most informed Republicans were unlikely to recognize that things had changed for the better, even though they had over that period.
You found a similar effect in a previous survey in which well-informed Democrats were asked whether inflation had gone down during Reagan's presidency.
Inflation went from 13.5% when Reagan took office to about 4% at the end of his two terms. And again, most Democrats thought that inflation had actually increased or remained unchanged during Reagan's presidency. One of the things that comes with information is a better understanding of what arguments are or are not acceptable based on their predispositions.
Bartels tabulated how the U.S. economy fared when Democrats were in the White House and when Republicans were in the White House.
The average level of real income growth for middle-income families has been about three times as great under Democratic presidents as it has been under Republican presidents. And the average rate of real income growth for working poor families has been about 10 times as large under Democratic presidents as it has been under Republican presidents.
And yet Republicans win more elections, partly because of the widespread belief that they've been better guardians of the economy.
It's been very well established that the incumbent party, whichever party it is likely to do well when the economy is flourishing and is likely to get thrown out of office when the economy is in bad shape. Democratic presidents tend to stimulate the economy when they first come into office. and that stimulation isn't likely to persist over the entire four-year term, and so things are cooling down by the time the presidential election comes around, whereas Republican presidents often come in and tap or slam on the brakes, and we have a recession or a period of slow growth in the beginning part of the administration and then begin to grow out of that when the next election comes around.
Bartels has written that, quote, voters cannot manage the task of competent retrospection. They forget all about most previous experience with the incumbents and vote solely on how they feel about the most recent months. So now combine short-term memory loss with irrational responses to the "are you better off now" question, and it's no longer surprising that democracy is such a blooming mess.
I've done a study looking at the responses of voters on the Jersey Shore to shark attacks in 1916. And it turns out that in the places where the economy was bad in the summer of 1916 because of well-publicized shark attacks, voters took it out on Woodrow Wilson when he ran for re-election. We've also looked over the course of the entire 20th century at voters' responses to droughts and floods. And again, it seems as though there's a pretty systematic tendency for them to blame the incumbent party, whoever's in charge, when things are too wet or too dry at the time of the election.
So, using all the parts of your brain that you can muster, you can see that candidates playing on our human vulnerabilities are certainly to blame. And the media, manipulative and manipulated and craven to boot, are also to blame. And then there's me and you. And we're...
Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Ah, to hell with it. I blame the media. Coming up, can man live by campaign ads alone? Live? Maybe.
Stay sane? Not by a long shot. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems, the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org, and the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Politics is regarded as a rich man's game, but it can also be a rich kid's game. All that's required is the will and the means. In Kentucky's 4th District congressional primaries this year, an outside super PAC spent more than $500,000 to make Thomas Massey, a libertarian-leaning candidate, a winner. Here's an ad from the Super PAC.
Thomas Massey has a blueprint that will bring jobs back. Thomas Massey, a conservative who will walk the walk. Liberty for All Super PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
The money behind the ad does not come from Karl Rove's American Crossroads Super PAC. That one's not big on libertarians. No, the money behind that Massey ad came primarily from a 22-year-old spending his inheritance. John Ramsey describes himself as an angel investor for Liberty for All, a super PAC focused on promoting down-ticket libertarian candidates across the country.
I wanted to see an organization that was there to facilitate a conversation, to show voters they now have a choice, because Republicans and Democrats, they are uniquely the same, it seems. So, you know, they're both very pro-war, they both spend a lot of money, they both borrow a lot of money. We got to be real, Bob, we're broke.
Well, where did the money come from to begin with that enabled you to go about underwriting this super PAC?
Yes, sir. So I'm very fortunate to come from a detailed family business background. My grandfather and I was very close to him from a young age. He passed away 2 years back, leaving my siblings and I responsible for what he had amassed.
You planned to build an organization to support many a candidate. You started with a guy named Thomas Massey, who was running for a congressional seat in Kentucky. How did Liberty for All decide to make him the test case?
The process of Liberty for All goes through to vet candidates is, first of all, do they match our values? And second of all, can they win? I mean, yeah, it would be nice to go after, you know, someone like Nancy Pelosi, but that's not going to happen. I wanted to be able to take to investors a track record of success, and therefore it would be much more likely for them to want to invest their time and money with us. So quickly after Thomas Massey's race, our next target we got involved was in the Michigan 11th with a man named Kerry Bentivoglio. That's two victories that we've been primarily accountable for this cycle.
Are your folks, like, down with this? I mean, anyone say you're gonna do what? With Grandpa's money, you're going to do what? Did you go through that?
Some people close to me were like, hey, you're going to be associating yourself with special interests, the big corporate lobbyists. You know, do you really want to be associated with those people? And, you know, I said, you know, I understand where you're coming from with the special interest, but I'm looking to build an organization that represents the special interests of the American people. But honestly, I didn't build anything special, Bob. It was built by the American values of civil liberties and economic freedom that helps us be sustainable here.
You're speechifying. I want to know whether your parents got mad at you for squandering Grandpa's inheritance.
No, not at all. For me to be able to spend this kind of money to enhance the goodness of mankind and being sincere about electing true freedom candidates to office, they're very supportive of that.
Now, you're from East Texas. You're not from the 4th District of Kentucky. Residents of the 4th District of Kentucky were minding their own business when all of a sudden in parachutes this super PAC from out of state and essentially spends Massey into office. Do you think they have a grievance about carpetbaggers coming in and trying to influence their election?
Well, I don't think so. The organization came in and facilitated a conversation. They identified information is key in this situation. I mean, it's not like we came in and we're bribing anyone to do anything. It's just facilitating a conversation and coming in and actually pointing out the truth.
Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure.
John Ramsey is a college student taking time off from Stephen F. Austin State University to be an angel investor in Liberty for All. There are only a few true swing states this election, and that means between now and November 6th, there are only a few targets for super PACs to hammer with advertising. Woe to TV-watching Ohioans who are probably longing for a car ad or an erectile dysfunction commercial to leaven the political fare. And it's only going to get worse. Slate contributor Seth Stevenson lives in New York, an Obama stronghold. To get a flavor for what swing state voters are enduring, he flew to Dayton, Ohio, checked into the airport Holiday Inn, tuned to local TV, and gorged on political ads for a solid 45 hours.
I sort of mainlined the experience. The idea was, you know, when I was there, there were still about 74 days left before the election. And I couldn't stay in Ohio for 74 days. That would have been a tall order for this assignment. So I decided to squeeze it all into 45 hours and just watch as many commercials as I could. So what I did was the second I checked into the room and dropped my bags and flopped on the bed, I clicked on the TV and I looked for the first commercial pod I could find. And I watched through it, waiting for the possibility of a political ad. And then as soon as an actual show started, I would flip again until I found the next commercial pod and watch it until I saw a political ad. After you see the same ad 21 times, which I did with at least one of the Romney ads, you start to focus on tiny moments, on the minutiae, on the subtext. I became obsessed with this one moment in a Romney ad where you see him, he's talking to a voter very earnestly, and he gulps. And when you see him gulp 21 times, you just can't help but wonder things like, wow, did the team editing the ad think about taking the gulp out because it made Romney look weak? Did they leave it in on purpose because it humanized Romney and looked like he really was feeling something in that moment with the voter? And now you've gone way past thinking about Mitt Romney as a president, and now you're just thinking about these strange media tactics and what's going on behind the scenes.
But do you really have any evidence that people who are not on an assignment pay enough attention to be asking themselves questions about the provenance of Mitt Romney's gulp?
I have no evidence. I have not conducted double-blind surveys of Ohio residents to find out if this is true or not. But I feel I am a normal person, and I was watching these ads. Yes, I was watching with heightened attention and a quadruple dose in a very short time period. But I do feel like when you see these ads over and over again, and I've seen this in my own life with regular ads for products and services, I find that I start to focus on little details in the ads, the way someone twitches their lip as they say the slogan or some little moment of a graphic. I find that happens to me with regular ads that I'm not trying to force feed myself. So I think it's entirely possible that it could happen to the average Ohio voter.
Once your mind started to scramble and lose the thread of the text of these spots, what broke through?
It happened by brute force. It was the ones I saw most often. And so that was one ad for Obama, which looked at Mitt Romney's tax plan and sort of folded it into Mitt Romney's own tax returns and the fact that he was only paying a 14% tax rate.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
You work hard, stretch every penny, but chances are you pay a higher tax rate than him. Mitt Romney made $20 million in 2010. But paid only 14% in taxes.
The one where you see Mitt Romney in profile highlighted against a giant Trump private jet. They're really letting you know that Mitt Romney is pals with Donald Trump and often flies on his plane. In every pro-Obama ad, I found that Mitt Romney looked fantastic. He would just always be in these crisp suits and power ties, looking just every bit the out-of-touch plutocrat. And then when you shift over and you see the pro-Romney ads, there he is in the open-collar windowpane shirt with a concerned expression on his face, khaki pants, looking like one of the people. It's amazing how the two campaigns, like, the Obama campaign wants to make him look like this put-together guy, and the Romney campaign wants to make him look like a disheveled dad.
There's one where he's actually driving to show, I guess, that he does things like that.
That in fact, he does not use a chauffeur every time he takes to the roads. Yeah, the interesting thing about that, so this is an ad that sort of lays out his professional resume. He talks about how he started Bain and saved the Olympics and was governor of Massachusetts. And the spatial relationship of the viewer is you're sitting in the passenger seat of this SUV as Mitt Romney drives you around and tells you about himself.
My own experience was I got the chance to start my own business. I know what it's like to hire people and to wonder whether you're going to be able to make ends meet down the road.
It's this very, I noticed, a very shoulder-to-shoulder male kind of communication, like a barstool kind of communication, or we're sitting together watching the game together as we talk about things. And it was such a contrast if you look in the Obama ads. When you see Obama, he's usually looking right into the camera. He's sort of locking eyes with you like you're on a promising first date. And again, I mean, I wonder if that is in line with the fact that Obama's doing better with female voters, whereas Romney's doing better with male voters.
You wrote about hearing again and again, I'm fill in the blank and I approve this message. What kind of effect did that have on you?
Oh, it sort of started to infiltrate my dreams.
I'm Barack Obama and I approve this message.
And I approve this message. I'm Mitt Romney.
I'm Barack Obama and I approve this message.
They speak the line in a different way. Obama's got a very slow, you know, unhurried way of saying it. I found Romney's was pretty nasally and kind of rushed. I think actually he was losing the battle of message approval.
And I wasn't even aware that that was a category. I'm worried about you personally. I know you sound fine now, but after undergoing something like this or waterboarding, there's often post-traumatic stress.
I bet if you did some sort of brain scan of me as I walked out of that hotel room, there would have been some kind of changes in the chemical makeup of my brain. I'm sure of that. I felt so fried when I came out of there. You know, my thumb hurt from clicking the remote control so often. I think I may have had bed sores. I was eating the same quesadillas again and again. Then I don't need to hear any more of the ad hominem arguments that are coming from both sides, or I'm done with it.
Did you learn anything? Did you learn any single thing about the candidates from watching these spots?
Absolutely not. In fact, you know, there was a Romney spot that was talking about Obama removing the work requirement from welfare. And, the ad talked about, first of all, I found it interesting. It was in second person. It said,
under Obama's plan, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check.
I thought that was interesting. They put it in second person like that. It's sort of, there's an understanding that, hey, we're all hard workers here and we would never want to just get our welfare check for nothing. And I said, oh, well, that's interesting. That seems like a strong argument to be making to the hardworking people of Ohio. And then I got home and I read some fact-checking column that said that it was just totally hooey. So I had the opposite of a learning experience. I was completely disinformed.
Seth, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Seth Stevenson wrote about the experience for The New Republic.
As reporters relentlessly cover the horse race, they're often missing what may be the biggest part of the story, why campaigns do what they do. That often is missed behind a curtain of privately gathered, staggeringly granular data. Two of our producers started digging into this, and they're here now, I guess, to gripe about the lapse in coverage. Chris Neary, welcome to this side of the mic.
Hi there.
PJ Vogt, welcome to you too.
Hey.
So starting with PJ, what's behind this curtain?
So reporters still slice voters into archetypes. You know, middle-aged white males, college students, seniors, soccer moms. But campaigns, more and more, just look at you. We know that for the past 5 to 10 years, they've been doing what they call micro-targeting. That just means that they're setting their sights on actual individual voters. Sasha Eisenberg is the author of Victory Lab, a book about what goes on behind the curtain. He said to us that each of us has a specific entry in these databases.
Which is your name, your address, gender, age, in some cases race, ethnicity. Then there is information from the census about your block or the neighborhood in which you live, which allows the campaign to make projections about your socioeconomic status, your education level, household type.
Then campaigns add more data from commercial firms. So now they know that you subscribe to The New Yorker, that you have a weird obsession with sports, that you went on a vacation with your wife, Michelle.
I'd like to point out to listeners that PJ has stopped describing a hypothetical person and is now describing just me.
I know. I'm sorry. But honestly, for a campaign, you aren't a hypothetical.
They're running algorithms. They're basically looking for patterns between that big, massive data they have about each of you with the information their polling tells them about specific attitudes about the election that's underway.
Here's a case in point. Back in 2002, Mitt Romney was running for governor of Massachusetts. His team was buried in data points, and they were searching for clues about those voters who didn't plan to vote for Romney, but could be convinced.
One of the attributes that unified them was a likelihood of being a premium cable subscriber, basically having HBO.
The campaigns didn't care why premium cable subscribers were more persuadable. They just wanted to find a correlation. But journalists care. So they struggle to find a reason. You know, swing voters seem to have responded to Romney's tough-on-crime policies because it reminded them of The Wire.
That's a stretch.
Yeah, but in 2004, when Bush won re-election, there were a lot of data stories that were nearly that crazy. Here's an example from Eisenberg.
This idea that Karl Rove figured out that Republicans drink bourbon and Coors, and then he went out and found them, and then he got them all to vote a lot more. Almost every part of it is false or exaggerated in ways that totally misrepresent it.
Sure, the Republicans looked at consumer buying habits, but that's just a small part of what's going on behind the curtain. Campaigns are targeting groups of voters that we, as reporters, don't even think of as a group. And if we don't understand the campaign strategy, it's really hard to evaluate if it's working or not.
Okay, so PJ's story is about the magnitude of data. My story is about how it's actually used in the ground game. You know, phone banks and canvassing and, most boring of all, direct mail. Reporters don't report on direct mail unless it's horribly, juicily offensive. But in Michigan, in 2006, a group of researchers randomly selected potential voters from a study group and then sent them one of four different letters. Here's one of those researchers, Columbia's Don Green, explaining how the letters worked.
Each more strongly than the next enforced the norm of civic duty.
The first letter basically reminded you that, yeah, as a society, we've decided voting is good, and please remember that. Then the second letter told you that researchers were actually tracking whether you voted.
Telling people that whether they complied with this norm was going to be monitored as a matter of public record. The point of the study wasn't to make people feel bad. It was basically to test this very basic social psychological proposition about the importance of norms.
Okay, now something from letter three, which was addressed to an entire household and gave the voting history of each member. Here, book, read it.
Okay.
It does sort of make you feel bad.
This chart shows your name from a list of registered voters showing past votes, as well as an empty box, which we will fill in to show whether you vote in the August 8th primary election. We intend to mail you an updated chart when we have that information. Yikes.
All right. And finally, the fourth letter.
Okay. We're sending this mailing to you and your neighbors to publicize who does or who does not vote. The chart shows the names of some of your neighbors, showing which have voted in the past. After the August 8th election, we intend to mail an updated chart. You and your neighbors will all know who voted and who did not. Chris, that sounds like blackmail.
Well, each of the letters boosted turnout, but guess which one worked the best?
The last one, right?
Oh, yeah. Three times more effective than any other piece of mail ever tested. That's certainly enough to flip a close election. So behavioral psychology is increasingly used as a weapon in campaign wars. And by the way, Brooke, you'll never get that last letter. Campaigns hate to send out anything that prompts virulent hate mail in return. And one of those researchers got some of that mail. But they are running other tests. Let's bring in Hal Malchow here. He says tiny adjustments can dramatically change behavior, like in political fundraising letters, where once a shop accidentally misprinted the stamps on their envelopes and found out that that actually mattered.
They tilted the stamp slightly to the right and got a better response rate on the mailing. I once did a test where every single word of the letter was exactly the same, except that on the carrier envelope and at the top of the letterhead, I put a little campaign graphic, and it says Fowler for Senate, something like that. 30% difference.
Malchow was one of the first political consultants to harness data for direct mail. Those crazy, desperate-sounding emails you get from Obama or Romney asking for money? Malchow says if they're doing it, they've tested it, and it works.
Okay, guys, that actually is fascinating, but what's your gripe?
Campaign reporters need to focus on this stuff. This is the real battlefield.
And look, we know the reporters don't have access to those databases or the results of the tests the campaigns are running.
But Eisenberg says that's no reason to give up reporting on campaign data.
I think that there's a sort of useful analogy to military coverage. People who cover the Pentagon realize they don't understand how drones work. They don't understand how drone targeting is done. And yet, military correspondents have figured out how to write that ambiguity and uncertainty and unknowability as part of the story and not confuse our readers into thinking that we know everything about what they're doing with drones.
So look, we don't want reporters to break into the data centers. We just want them to be honest about what they don't know.
And to adjust their narratives to the age of algorithms. I mean, Brooke, is that so much to ask?
Yeah, probably. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Brooke.
Thanks, VJ.
Thanks.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week on this show, we talked about the 1934 California gubernatorial race of Upton Sinclair against Frank F. Merriam, and how Sinclair was undone by a political campaign of unprecedented coordination and ferocity. This included tactics like the out-of-context quotation, relentless pamphleteering, and what they now call opposition research. Techniques new at the time, but these days part of the standard playbook. The masterminds behind that campaign were named Clem Whitaker and Leon Baxter, the owners of Campaigns, Inc., the world's first political consulting firm. Jill Lepore profiled Campaigns, Inc. in a recent issue of The New Yorker. Jill, welcome to OTM.
Hey, thanks.
Who were these people?
They come from the world of newspaper journalism, but they also are borrowing from the techniques of the modern advertising business that's just started. Clem Whitaker had been a longtime newspaper reporter. He also founded a wire service, the California Feature Service. And Leon Baxter, who's this young widow, is hired to work with him on his first political campaign. They fall in love. He divorces his first wife and marries her. They work behind the scenes. No one really pays much attention to who they are. You know, Upton Sinclair writes a book about what's been done to him, and he calls it the Lie Factory. But he doesn't even really know who's done it, who's behind it. They use invented organizations to print pamphlets all the time. So it's very different from political consultants today who very much adore the limelight and are very much celebrities.
And yet, semi-anonymous as they were, they dominated this fledgling industry, winning 70 out of 75 campaigns. What was their secret sauce?
Well, the first thing they do is they hibernate for a weekend or some number of days when they're hired by any campaign, and they come up with a plan of campaign. They come up with all the rhetoric that they're going to use, exactly the way they're going to position their candidate. Then they write an opposition plan of campaign to imagine that there was someone actually opposing them, but there is no opposition. There are no other political consulting firms before the 1950s, so they're just really fighting their own shadow. They're boxing in the dark. But Whitaker says there's only two ways to interest Mr. or Mrs. America in a political campaign. You either have to put on a fight or you have to put on a show. It's no coincidence that political consulting comes out of California. It's very much bound up with Hollywood. Whitaker and Baxter had a rule. You know, if you have to explain something, you've already lost the issue. You never explain. Your obligation is to simplify the message and go on the attack. You can't win a defensive campaign.
One of their tricks was to come up with an allegation and just repeat it endlessly, no matter how, you know, dubious its merits.
Among their rules was this. You have to say something seven times to make a sale.
It also has echoes of Goebbels, the dynamics of the big lie. Were they on the same track?
You know, it's something that people in the 1930s were very concerned about with radio in general. There's a lot of concern in the 30s about propaganda in Europe. There's obviously a lot of concern about the border between fact and fiction in American radio broadcasting. I mean, just think about War of the Worlds and the controversy that that sparks. Baxter, in particular, later in life, looking back at the work she had done, thought about, was there a difference between what she was doing in Nazi propaganda? Not obviously at the level of content. She thought what she was doing was principled and that her political arguments were sincere. And I think they indeed were sincere. But I think she had come to understand, and this is reflected in this quite powerful oral history interview that's conducted with her later in her life, you know, it's like sort of believing in a benevolent dictatorship. You can't accept that these tools are a good thing if it depends on the nobility of the intentions of the people who hold them.
What's so spooky about your New Yorker piece is how much it seems to presage what goes on today. Tell me about the campaign against government-mandated health insurance.
Whitaker and Baxter were first hired in the state of California to defeat Earl Warren's proposed statewide health insurance program in the 40s. They had actually gotten Warren elected governor, but he had then fired them. He was pretty concerned about the methods that they used. He proposed a health insurance program. They were hired by, Whitaker and Baxter were hired by the California Medical Association to defeat it. They used all of their classical methods. They decided that what Warren was proposing was creeping socialism. They invoked the specter of Stalinism. They defeated it successfully by one vote. Warren was outraged. Harry Truman then picked up the cause. Both in California and nationwide, compulsory health insurance was incredibly popular. What Whitaker and Baxter did when they were hired then subsequently by the American Medical Association was take those same techniques that they'd used to defeat health insurance in California and bring them to the nation at large. And they did so very much with an eye toward defeating not only that proposal that Truman had offered, but health insurance forever afterward. They tell the AMA, you are hiring us not just to defeat this piece of legislation, you are hiring us to put an end forever to the idea that the federal government could have anything to do with healthcare.
This whole conversation, Jill, is premised on the idea that Campaigns, Inc. created in the 30s. It's the template for all modern political campaigning. You mentioned that Baxter was herself interviewed late in her career. I guess she was asked about that issue. What was her response?
She lived till she was 95, so she saw a lot of change over the course of her lifetime. She admitted that a lot of the tools of political consulting had changed, because mainly you'd be using television by the time she was being interviewed, and she had almost never used television in the course of her career. But the basic philosophy and the messages that you would give your candidates, the way you would control candidates, one of the things that's so interesting about political consultants, a lot of research has shown that political consultants actually determine what issues are raised in a campaign. Candidates almost never even make that decision anymore. Baxter saw that, knew that. That had been how she had run her business starting in 1933.
All right. So if we agree that this kind of political consulting is repulsive in its cynicism, in its manipulation of the electorate, it's also completely protected by the thing we hold most dear, the First Amendment. Are we doomed to this kind of political cancer forever?
Oh, I don't think so. There was a great moment in the 50s when this political scientist named Stanley Kelly went around and interviewed a bunch of political consultants who were just starting out. He wrote this book about the founding of this industry. And he said, you know, what's going to happen? What's going to happen with this stuff? And one guy says to him, I give it a few months because really we're selling so much baloney. How much longer could anybody possibly believe a word we're telling them? You know, and you look at the footnote and it's this interview conducted in like June of 1955 and you're thinking, man, okay, it's been a long time coming, but I think it's just around the corner.
Jill, thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Bob.
Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard University. Her latest book is titled The Story of America.
That's Lee Atwater, who died in 1991. In the history of U.S. politics, it's hard to find a more complicated and influential power broker than he was. A son of South Carolina, where they know from dirty politics, Atwater played blues guitar and politics from an early age and rose to become the wunderkind campaign strategist for such notables as Strom Thurmond, Ronald Reagan, and George Herbert Walker Bush. It was Bush Sr. who eventually made Atwater the head of the Republican National Committee. Atwater's winning formula was simple. spin when you can, change the subject when you can't, and if all else fails, mine the voters' resentment and fear, especially of black people. A few years ago, we spoke with Stephen Forbes, the director of a documentary called Boogeyman, The Lee Atwater Story. He told us that Atwater played brilliantly on the smoldering rage of many Southern whites towards the secular, the elite, and the intellectual, people who they felt looked down on them. Atwater played that tune so well, he even made it work for the waspy, wealthy, very Northern George Herbert Walker Bush.
And he realized that they could take the party of the rich, of corporations, and turn it into the party of the working man. And he did it brilliantly by putting Bush Sr. into a cowboy hat, cowboy boots with big Texas flag on the side, and having him eat pork rinds. He single-handedly pretty much created the Bush dynasty, was a mentor to Karl Rove, and taught W how to campaign. Even from his grave, he's been winning elections for the Republican Party.
He single-handedly created George Herbert Walker Bush. How did he get to him to begin with?
It's an amazing story. Back in 1972, you have an obscure guy running for chairman of the College Republicans from Utah. His name's Karl Rove. Atwater's his campaign manager, and they lose. But Atwater won't accept defeat. They start throwing out ballots, challenging people's right to vote. It gets thrown all the way up the chain to the chairman of the Republican Party, George H.W. Bush, who sees these two hard-knuckled young operatives and gives them the election. And right there, Karl Rove learns from Lee Atwater how to win an election.
And Rove worked with Atwater on Vice President Bush's 1988 campaign against Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. At that point, Bush was knee-deep in the Iran-Contra scandal. He was lagging in the polls. And then Atwater changed the subject with two political ads. The first targeted a Massachusetts prison furlough program by highlighting a black convict that we all still remember named Willie Horton.
It's incredible. Back in 88, in that campaign, Ronald Reagan has literally sold arms to terrorists and lied about it on national TV. Atwater was able to change the subject. He found a fairly irrelevant convict that was out on parole, Willie Horton, and made him the focus of that entire campaign. And his own party laughed at him.
His revolving door prison policy gave weekend furloughs to first-degree murderers not eligible for parole. While out, many committed other crimes like kidnapping and rape.
Atwater was able to change the subject because he realized that the media is often like a school of fish. They're so anxious to chase the story and the prevailing narrative that an operative like Atwater is able to use them as an echo chamber. You put something out there that's sticky, you know, the face of this scowling killer, and it can really swamp the whole dialogue on television.
So that first ad peddled fear. The second notorious ad of that campaign also relied on imagery, some frankly silly footage of Dukakis riding in a tank to peddle a lie.
Michael Dukakis has opposed virtually every defense system we developed. He opposed new aircraft carriers. He opposed anti-satellite weapons. He opposed four missile systems, including Pershing 2 missile deployment. Dukakis opposed the stealth bomber and a ground emergency warning.
Perception is reality. He was a governor. He hadn't voted on any of those weapon systems. But Atwater realized you find a powerful, sticky image that the media can't resist of this guy looking goofy in a tank helmet, and that will dwarf the rest of the conversation. It was so convincing that even someone like Sam Donaldson, in looking back on it in the film, says, gee, I wonder if we really vetted all those claims. I'm not sure we did. Again, you hide in plain sight. You tell a lie that's so powerful that people can't quite understand that the whole basis on which it's being discussed isn't true. When George Bush Sr. appointed Lee Atwater head of the Republican National Committee, he was in effect taking these campaign tactics and putting them in charge of the party at the highest level. Then, when Atwater's acolyte Karl Rove won successfully in 2000, he took those same tactics into the White House and used them as a basis for governing. So it's been fascinating to trace the Atwater playbook through these different administrations.
Atwater just plain lied.
Well, what I see is that Atwater's vision of politics is pro-wrestling. because they didn't pretend to be anything other than fake. You know, that kind of cynicism really infected a whole generation of political reporters in Washington and a generation of political operatives. Atwater was able to sort of pull back the curtain on politics to say, hey, let me show you how we do our polling, and look at this horse race, isn't it great? Kind of divested them of the moral imperative to talk about the truth. And you saw that come back with incredible power in the 04 campaign when these Swift Boat ads came out. And for about 3 weeks, the media really did not vet those charges.
In 1991, he was 40 years old. He had been made head of the Republican National Committee, and Atwater developed a brain tumor. And then he was portrayed in the media as having a real period of actual repentance. He was sorry for what he did before he died. Was that true?
I was, again, incredibly surprised to find out that the truth was much more complicated than it had been reported. Friends of Atwater told me he never even repented for negative campaigning. The fact is, though, as Tucker Eskew, senior advisor to the McCain-Palin campaign, says, the fear tactics that he had used on America came back on him. He would lie awake at night, desperately afraid that he was going to hell. He apologized to a couple of people. They say he actually sent a telegram to Willie Horton apologizing for what he'd done, but he didn't send anything to Mike Dukakis, as was reported in Life magazine. He still doesn't apologize for making the Republican Party a Southern party, for putting the right-wing evangelicals, whom he privately mocked, as freaks, as guys with hands growing out of their heads, for putting them in firm control of Republican politics. He didn't repent for any of that.
So why did you make this film? Is it just a cautionary tale, or is it a kind of Shakespeare tragedy?
I didn't set out to make a movie to hold Atwater accountable and let the rest of us off the hook. I mean, the fact that a guy who pals around with James Brown and B.B. King runs the most racist presidential campaign in 150 years— that reflects America's hypocrisy about race. Atwater does all these things and then gets down on his knees and somehow seeks redemption at the end of his life. That's our country all over again. We like to sin on Saturday night and get down on our knees Sunday morning.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Stephen Forbes is the director of Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story, which you can find at boogeymanfilm.com. Conclude this show about elections with a song from Gilbert and Sullivan's Iolanthe, my favorite, about a man named Streffen whose upper half is fairy and lower half human. He's the most powerful member of parliament. None can resist his fairy eloquence. But he's got a problem. To the waist, he says, I'm a Tory of the most determined description, but my legs are a couple of confounded radicals. Most of us are not plagued with such duality. We think we know what's right in our bones. In the September issue of Trends in Genetics, researchers Peter Hatemi and Rose McDermott reviewed a series of studies of twins, and they found that upbringing seems to be the prime factor in our choice of political party. However, the data suggests that the drive to acquire political knowledge and to vote may actually be imprinted in our genes. What's more, research suggests that a gene called DRD4 may be implicated in the development of our political leanings. If you have a variant of that gene called 7R and acquired a large network of friends during adolescence, you're more likely to be liberal. A hat tip to The Economist, which last week, when pondering these findings, invoked the song of the soldier on guard duty in Iolanthe. Fa-la-la, fa-la-la, how nature always does contrive, fa-la-la-la, that every boy and every girl that's born into the world alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. Nature, nurture, emotion, evolution, and the conscious mind. The ruling forces in your head are sickeningly opaque. You might want to duck responsibility for what goes on up there, but you can't exactly run off to Canada. The politics in your head are pretty much the same as the politics outside. Jefferson said, "The price of freedom is eternal vigilance." See you at the polls.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Lita Martinez, Ariel Stuhlberg, and Andy Lancet. And edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was James Coyle.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our fabulous blog at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.